ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 15th of April. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Investigations are continuing into the mass murder at Bondi Junction in Sydney's East on Saturday, which left six people dead and 12 others in hospital. Police say the attacker, 40-year-old Queensland man Joel Couchy, suffered mental illness and was shot dead by a police inspector at the shopping centre where the attack happened. Gavin Coote reports.
Across from the Westfield shopping centre in Bondi Junction, floral tributes are being laid on the footpath. Hundreds of people, including John Tognolini, have come to pay their respects.
Well, what can people say? Yeah, that's the least we can do. The families, and people are just horrified.
While people went about their shopping on Saturday afternoon, Queensland man Joel Couchy went on a deadly rampage with a large knife. As the centre went into lockdown, Bondi lifeguard Andrew Reid was helping paramedics treat the victims.
So he lifted the shutter up and let me out, and I went around the corner, and just what I saw was crazy. Like, it was just victim after victim sort of spread out about every 50 metres.
Emergency responders sprung into action. First, there was Police Inspector Amy Scott. She told the 40-year-old attacker to drop his knife before shooting him and administering first aid. It wasn't the only act of bravery. Footage emerged of another man, armed with what appeared to be a bollard, confronting Joel Couchy on an escalator. New South Wales Premier Chris Minns says their bravery saved lives.
And of course, Inspector Amy Scott, who ran towards danger, showed professionalism and bravery, and without a shadow of the doubt, saved many, many lives.
Police believe Joel Couchy came to New South Wales last month. He had a history of mental health issues. Commissioner Karen Webb says a full investigation is underway, but at this stage, there is no evidence that it was ideologically motivated. Most of the victims were female, raising questions whether the attack was directed at women.
The issue of whether it was a female issue or not is an obvious line of inquiry for us. We've seen that in the video, it's been reported to us, and it's obvious in the numbers. So that's something we will explore. We may not have answers. We may never get answers because we can't ask him, and it will be based on what we can determine from interviewing witnesses.
Among those killed was 38-year-old Ashley Good, who was attacked alongside her 9-month-old baby and later died in hospital. The baby remains in a critical but stable condition. Dawn Singleton, the 25-year-old daughter of businessman John Singleton, also died in the attack. She was engaged to be married. Other victims identified are mother of two Jade Young, artist Pikri Adachia, and Faraz Tahir, a 30-year-old Pakistani national who was working as a security guard. At this busy shopping hub, which, along with nearby Bondi Beach, draws people from around the world, many like Barry McKay are struggling to make sense of what's happened.
There are a lot of traumatised people here today, a lot of frightened people here.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has requested for the Australian flag to be flown at half-mast on all government buildings in honour of the victims.
Gavin Coote reporting there. Bondi Junction serves as a focal point for Sydney's eastern suburbs. Reporter Alison Shaw is there. Alison, what's it like there this morning?
Sabra, it is very quiet here at Bondi Junction. People who are walking past are going about their normal mornings, walking to work or going to a gym class, but all with the knowledge of what's happened here over the weekend. And there is this huge floral tribute that's here with dozens of flowers outside the Westfield, and it's a display of the community's grief over this sad and senseless attack. And there's also been candles that have been lit near the flowers and a condolence book for members of the community to write messages of hope and support. There is also still a police presence here at Bondi Junction, with many areas still taped off and a mobile command unit here as well. But most areas are still accessible, and I've spoken to a few locals this morning about how they're feeling, and this is what some of them had to say.
I think the community and the neighbourhood here will take, you know, a moment to process this, but we're a resilient lot. It'll bounce back. We know this wasn't this. We know this is a blip, right? It's not politically motivated or otherwise. I think answers will be needed, and I think they'll come in due time.
I felt drawn to come down this morning just to see all the tributes, just to feel the sense of place, really, because it's still so unreal and shocking.
And I noticed you writing in the condolence book. Do you feel like, how do you feel about the outpouring of community grief and support that's been on show?
It makes me feel really proud of living in my suburb. And funnily enough, I've always thought this suburb was just a hub where people came to and went out of. But now I feel that it has a real heart. And in the condolence book, I read a poem this morning about kindness, and that resonated with me. So I just wrote Only Kindness.
And Alison, what's the latest on those who were taken to hospital for their injuries, including the 9-month-old baby girl?
Sabra, there are now 8 people being treated in hospitals across Sydney, so a few people have been discharged over the weekend. But of the remaining patients in hospital, one patient, a woman, is in a critical condition at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, but most other patients are in stable conditions, while another woman and that 9-month-old baby girl are in serious but stable conditions in hospital.
Reporter Alison Shaw there in Bondi Junction. So what do we know about the attacker, Joel Cauchy, and why he did what he did? His family has described their son's actions as truly horrific. Cauchy was diagnosed with a mental illness when he was a teenager, and police say he'd been living out of a car or in backpacker hostels, mostly in southeast Queensland, for years. Queensland police say he was known to them, but he was never arrested or charged, as Stephanie Smale reports.
As the search for answers continues, police are door-knocking homes on the outskirts of Toowoomba, a city about 2 hours west of Brisbane. It's where Joel Cauchy grew up, and before he moved to Sydney, he lived on and off at his parents' home. Joel Cauchy was diagnosed with a mental illness when he was 17. Queensland Police Assistant Commissioner Roger Lowe says the 40-year-old has moved around a lot in the past few years, and his family last heard from him in March.
We believe he has been sleeping in a vehicle or backpacks, according to the family's information.
Police say his family recognised him in news footage of the attack and called them almost immediately. In a statement, his family have described their son's actions as truly horrific. They say they have no issues with the police officer who shot their son, as she was only doing her job to protect others. Assistant Commissioner Lowe says Joel Cauchy's family has had limited contact with him recently and know little about his movements in recent months.
He has led an itinerant lifestyle over the last number of years where he's come and gone from Brisbane or the Gold Coast. So they were aware he was not in Queensland through texts, but not aware of where or how or whom he may have been associating or living with or where he may have been.
Joel Cauchy last came into contact with police during a so-called street check on the Gold Coast in December last year. But Assistant Commissioner Lowe says he wasn't ever arrested or charged. One of the big questions now is what was his state of mind when he went on his deadly rampage. Queensland police say although he was known to police, they had no cause to alert interstate authorities about him.
Mental health in society is not a crime. We do not run an intelligence regime on persons who suffer from mental health.
Criminologists say his mental health is only part of the profile police will be examining. Dr. Xanthi Mallett is a forensic criminologist at the University of Newcastle.
Whilst that is an element that needs to be looked at, it's not the only thing that will have led to this event.
Does it make it more challenging to pick up warning signs if someone is living an itinerant lifestyle?
It certainly does, because if there's nobody around them to really check that they're okay, mentally okay, then warning signs may be missed.
In their statement, Joel Cauchy's family says their thoughts and prayers are with the families and friends of the victims and those still undergoing treatment.
Stephanie Smale reporting there. Israel is considering its response to the unprecedented wave of Iran missiles and drones on the weekend, vowing to extract a price. Iran launched hundreds of projectiles during the direct assault on Israel, and it was in retaliation to a suspected Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic complex in Syria earlier this month. Tel Aviv says it shot down 99% of the weapons with assistance from the United States and the United Kingdom. Middle East correspondent Alison Horn is in Jerusalem. Alison, Iran's warning of a bigger response if Israel retaliates. Are we on the brink of a much wider war in the Middle East?
Well, Sabra, that's the fear, and it's definitely not without merit. Never before has Iran launched a direct attack on Israel. And likewise, Israel is considering a response that may also be unprecedented. Israel says about 350 drones and missiles, both cruise missiles and ballistic missiles, were fired by Iran towards Israel. Most of them, with the help of the US, the UK and French military, were intercepted. So only a few missiles fell within Israel itself. But the big question now is, how will Israel respond? That really will set the tone for whether or not this situation could spark a war.
Israel's war cabinet has been meeting to discuss its response. Any word from that yet?
Well, it's clear there will be some sort of a response, whether that's a direct hit on Iranian soil or on Iranian proxies like Hezbollah in Lebanon or perhaps the Houthis in Yemen, for example. We had expected there would be some sort of retaliation by now, because it's actually going on about 24 hours since Iran launched those missiles and drones. And Israel was saying that it would immediately respond, but that hasn't happened. Israel's war cabinet has just met, and although officials say that everyone does favour some sort of retaliation, it's reported that there is division over the timing and scale of any such response. And I think the fact that we haven't seen any response so far really backs that up, that Israel is still uncertain on exactly what action it's going to take.
The United States says it won't participate in any Israeli strike on Iran. Joe Biden says a further response isn't necessary. How likely is it that Israel will take heed of that?
Well, I think it can't be underestimated. Joe Biden is calling Israel's defence of its country a success and saying that's as far as this situation should go, that Iran retaliated after those Iranian officials were killed in an airstrike, and the matter should stop here now. But you have to look at Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and his cabinet, the most right-wing coalition in Israel's history, with some cabinet members who will be vigorously pressing for a strong retaliation, which would result in an escalation. And Benjamin Netanyahu needs to keep those people on side if he wants to stay in power. But there is no doubt that there's virtually no appetite here from any players around the Middle East to have a wider regional war between these two enemies that would undoubtedly draw in Iranian allies, including Lebanon, Syria, Yemen and Iraq. And Sabra, given we haven't seen a response yet, I think we can take that as an indication that Israel is taking these threats of escalation and isolation from the United States seriously.
It's Middle East correspondent Alison Horne. A judgment is expected today in Bruce Learman's defamation battle with the Ten Network and journalist Lisa Wilkinson. The former Liberal staffer says he was defamed when the TV program The Project aired an interview with Brittany Higgins, where she alleged she'd been raped at Parliament House, although he wasn't named. Mr. Learman launched the defamation case after his criminal trial over the alleged rape was abandoned, with no findings against him. Elizabeth Byrne has been following the case closely. Elizabeth, this is a highly anticipated verdict. Is there any way of predicting what we're likely to see when the federal court judge delivers his verdict today?
Well, I wouldn't like to predict the ultimate outcome, but the things the judge had to decide was he defamed at all, because he wasn't named in the interview with Channel 10? And then secondly, did Network 10's defence of truth stand up? Because if he was defamed, he may still not be eligible for any damages if the truth case were to stand up. Now, there are three options there. Either the judge finds that on the balance of probabilities, he did rape Brittany Higgins, or on the balance of probabilities, he didn't, or strike some middle ground. And it's very difficult to say which way he'll jump. Justice Michael Lee keeps saying things like, I don't want anyone to read anything into this, when he asks the question. So he's playing his cards close to his chest, but we're fairly clear about the sorts of options he'll be looking at. And he'll also probably go into some kind of exploration of the credibility of the main witnesses.
There has been a lot of coverage in recent weeks about the evidence from former Channel 7 Spotlight producer Taylor Auerbach about the network and Bruce Learman's behaviour. Is that likely to have an impact?
Well, the more sensational allegations, probably not. They're probably something that Seven is grappling with more than anyone else. But the main thing that Network 10 wanted out of that evidence was his evidence that he says Bruce Lehrman gave him material that was not used in the criminal trial, but had been gathered for the criminal trial. And Bruce Lehrman had sort of denied this, and he said all he gave was an interview. And that would have meant that he had lied to the court. But as Bruce Lehrman's lawyer pointed out when he was trying to fight the reopening of the case, that he'd already conceded a lot of things and been shown to have lied about some things. And so what more benefit could you gain from showing that he had lied about something? Also, the judge pointed out towards the end of that evidence, and again, perhaps we shouldn't read anything into it, but he pointed out that there were other options available as to whether Seven got the material from Bruce Lehrman or someone else, because Seven has responded with, well, we don't reveal our sources. So still in the air, but, you know, it was a colourful corner of this extremely difficult and long case.
Are we likely to hear Federal Court Judge Michael Lee make any big statements today?
We may well. He's got quite a turn of phrase, but one thing I can tell you, Sabra, is that he plans to read extracts from the judgment, and it'll take 1 to 2 hours. So if anyone's going to log in for the latest Federal Court YouTube hit, that's what to expect.
Elizabeth Byrne reporting there. The past few weeks, Alice Springs has made headlines for the violence and crime gripping the Northern Territory town. But locals say there are a few things missing from a very one-dimensional representation of their home, and plenty to be proud of. Elsa Silberstein has more.
It's a sunny day, an hour out of Alice Springs. Locals frolic in the waterfalls of John Hayes Rock Hole, recently filled from heavy rain. It's a stark contrast to the police sirens echoing around town a few weeks ago as a state of emergency was declared on the 27th of March, following an outbreak of violence in the CBD. But the people of Alice Springs don't want to be defined by those national headlines. Because, apart from the overflowing waterholes, there's more to Alice Springs than its criminal record.
Well, that's always been Alice Springs. Everything's negative that's always highlighted here, and it's never too much of the good stuff. There's plenty of that around town as well, you know.
At the dog park next to a primary school in the suburbs, Reggie Smith is clipping the back and sides of a young Indigenous boy. Reggie's a barber with King's Narrative, a locally run free support service for Aboriginal men.
Lots of little families and kids and people come to get haircuts and hang out and play some games.
Reggie says there's a lot to celebrate about this place.
Oh, no, I love it. It's home, you know.
And he's been up close to the toughest parts of Alice Springs.
I grew up in a town camp, you know, so I've seen everything from poverty to domestic violence to alcohol, drug abuse, you know.
Reggie feels protective of the young Indigenous boys he gives haircuts to, vilified by some, in a town famous for its crime.
It is sad because you see some of these kids get ridiculed and looked down and looked differently for other kids doing the wrong things, you know, so it's all painting them under the same brush.
As night falls, the town's famous red Rocky McDonald ranges are lit up, glimmering with animated art from Central Australia. You can see it clearly from the middle of Parchima. It's an Aboriginal festival of light installations, and there's a pretty palpable sense of fun around the place. Emran Sultan's one of the artists here. He feels the privilege of being part of an ancient culture that's celebrated tonight.
Look, I grew up here and, you know, I love the town. Yeah, there's lots going on, but we can't deny the beauty of the place. I mean, standing here and looking out the sun, going down behind the ranges, you've got the different colours. It's a beauty.
You are on a Mandawa. We welcome you onto
Arunda
country.
Artist Emran Sultan, ending that report from Elsa Silberstein. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
It was a warm, sunny autumn afternoon. And like most Saturdays, the Westfield Shopping Centre in Bondi Junction in Sydney's east was heaving with shoppers. Tragedy unfolded, leaving six dead. Today, a criminologist on what we know about the offender and the investigation to come. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listener.